Thank you very much. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. So it's really a very exciting conference and learned a lot, certainly. So I, since I'm in the middle, I sort of started running of introductory slides because about every aspect has been shown. So, but one slide you haven't seen. So when we started working in the area of angiogenesis, I'm coming from modeling microcirculation generally. We looked at publications in the field, and we're sort of immediately scared by it. And here is, since we're quantitative people, here is how it looks. It's interesting if you dial it on PubMed. So as you can see, before about 89, the number of publications, even though it was really an active field at that time, but it's sort of in the noise area. And of course, in 1989, the growth factor was discovered, vascular endothelial growth factor, by several groups, including the one at Genentech. And as you can see, after that, the curve, actually we checked, it is exponential. You can plot it on log scale. It took Genentech, though, some 15 years to develop, to go from their discovery of the growth factor to a drug. And in 2004, two anti-angiogenic drugs were approved by FDA, first two. The first one by Genentech, Avastin, it's antibody to neutralizing VEGF. And the second one is Microgen. This is an aptamer, small molecule by ITAC developed. Avastin is for tumor cancer application, Microgen for macular degeneration, which is the cause number one of blindness in the Western world. So I will talk about primarily two families of molecules. One is VEGF. As you can see, interestingly, the number of publications, which is enormous, 3,000 per year on VEGF, so follows angiogenesis. And the second family that I will talk in detail will be matrix metalloproteinases, also sort of a recent development. The family is crowded, about some 30 members, and in 96, the discovery of membrane-based MMP, MT1 MMP, sort of sped up the progress. So here's sort of a stamp of our lab. This is just reiterating major processes in angiogenesis, the sensing of oxygen by parenchymal cells, tumor cells, myocytes, or fibroblasts, then secreting of VEGF, activation of epithelial cells on existing vessels, and then formation of sprout tip cell, and then followed by so-called stalk cells, and then mechanical factors play a role in it. So this is what the areas we're presently working on. So developing models at the molecular level, as you will see, they're a fairly detailed model of VEGF family and interactions with receptors, including neuropilins, very importantly. And then what I'll show you, two applications, one to potentially pro-angiogenic therapy in the peripheral arterial occlusive disease. This is a disease where the artery leading to, like, femoral artery is occluded, there's atherosclerosis, so is ischemic muscle, and it's cause of amputations and death. Approximately the same frequency, interestingly, although probably less attention than myocardial ischemia. And the second one of cancer, and the application I show will be for breast cancer. So I'll also lead you through some models of metalloproteinases. We have developed models of fibroblast growth factor 2, a basic FGF, and also we have a model for HIF-1 alpha that Celeste Simon talked about on day one. And then at the end, we are using agent-based modeling to put this all together. Just to have a glance of how this thing is put together, since the presentation is called Multiscale Integrative. So we actually have the modules of VEGF MMP require sort of full-time knowledge of this, of the biological events and the biochemistry, and is done by a single person, a graduate student or postdoctoral fellow, and the sort of they grow with time, written in different languages and different outputs and so on. So what we've done, we've developed an integrator that takes input from a module, whatever it's written in C++ or Fortran or another language. This is a Java-based module integrator, and then communicates. So it keeps coordinates of cells and concentrations of various species and so on. So these are molecular-based, or molecular-level modules. This is a cell-based or cell-level module, and then blood flow transport is a microvascular network scale. And this is accompanied by a very extensive database development, because as you imagine, there are a large number of parameters, and we try to get as precise or as values of parameters from biological literature from our collaborators. So I'll start with the models of VEGF receptor interactions. And so here's the picture. There are a number of VEGF genes. The 1989 discovery was for what is now known as VEGF-A, which is still considered the most important mitogen for angiogenesis, but there is also placental growth factor from the same family and several other VEGF types now. There is VEGF-E as well. So there are a number of receptors also that interact with this, and primarily these are receptor VEGF receptor 1, 2, and 3. The major signaling receptor is VEGF receptor 2, for blood for angiogenesis. Receptor 3 is primarily plays a role in lymph angiogenesis, and the role of receptor 1 is somewhat unknown at this point. It definitely modulates angiogenesis, but whether it's pro or anti-angiogenic depends on the context, and actually I might demonstrate some of this. There is also soluble receptor 1, which is very important and might be present in large concentrations, and a couple years ago it was discovered that this is the major cause for preeclampsia, the hypertension in pregnancy, is the presence of VEGF receptor 1 soluble form. Now, if we look at VEGF-A, it's a single gene, but there are in human five isoforms, splice isoforms. So this is at the RNA level is modified, and the modification is primarily in this part of exons 6 and 7, which has to do with heparin binding of this growth factor. And so this isoform, because it lacks exons 6 and 7, does not bind to the extracellular matrix, and this is freely diffusible isoform. The 121 and 165 are the most ubiquitous isoforms, and 165, that they in this direction, they bind stronger and stronger to the extracellular matrix. The presence of different isoform has profound effects on the vascular formation of the shape and the pattern of formation and the vascular walls. So it's quite important, and it's sort of fairly recent development of looking at which isoforms are expressed. So the 165 is the isoform that is implicated in pathological situations, and since I mentioned Avastin and Macrogen, there is an important difference between how they work. Avastin neutralizes all isoforms of VEGF presence, whereas Macrogen is directed toward the 165 isoform. Now, they are specific to receptors, and we can see that certain isoforms bind both receptors 1 and 2, and certain isoforms bind only receptor 1 but not receptor 2. And some isoform, and some forms of VEGF, including C, which is the major mitogen for lymph angiogenesis, promoter of lymph angiogenesis. Now, and then all isoforms larger than 121, this number just stands for the number of amino acids. This is 44 amino acids longer than 121, 165. All of them bind the glycosaminoglycan chains on the extracellular matrix, all except 121 and some of other members of the family. Now, the neuropilins has been known for maybe a couple decades as neural receptors that are responsible for directing neural growth, but In 1999, it was discovered on the endothelial cells, and they serve as co-receptors for VEGF. So there are neuropilin 1 and neuropilin 2. The most studied is neuropilin 1. And interestingly, neuropilin 1 can bind VEGF receptor 1 directly, and can form, can couple with VEGF receptor 2 through VEGF-165, sort of, which forms a bridge between the two receptors. You'll see that it has enormous impact on the dynamics of this. So here's what the geometrical situation is. I first will describe in vitro experiments and their simulation. In this case, there is no parenchymal cells, there is no extracellular matrix, there is a monolayer of endothelial cells that are expressing receptor 1, receptor 2, and neuropilin, or in some combination when these are transfected. And then VEGF is put in the solution, and then phosphorylation or other events are studied. On the in vivo situation, we have parenchymal cells, whether it's tumors, cells, or myocytes in the applications I show. they secrete VEGF in response to hypoxia, for example, or mechanical forces, as it turns out. And then there are processes of binding and dissociation. I haven't mentioned there is also a family of semaphorins that bind to neuropilin and therefore can compete with VEGF, and they have neuropilins are not signaling receptors, but plexins, another family, is a signaling receptor also present on endothelial cells. In fact, the situation is such that just about every receptor present on neurons is also present on endothelial cells, and they can interact, and they also have common ligand. Maybe not surprising in retrospect, because neural and vascular development goes hand in hand. So the first, what I show you is a model of VEGF receptor interactions in vitro. So we have two major isoforms, 121, 165. They're dimers, by the way. They're secreted as dimers. And then receptor two, neuropilin. So here's validate this model, and the model is basically, I don't give the equations, but the equations are reaction diffusion equations. The concentrations of every species is taken into account, that means receptor 121 and 165 and all the intermediate species bound to receptors and so on, including the triplets of VEGF, neuropilin, receptor 2. So we first validated this model against seven quantitative experiments available at that time, I guess 3 years ago. So this is one set of experiments where VEGF-165 is iodinated, and then endothelial cells are saturated in vitro with this ligand. And then you add so-called cold, non-iodinated VEGF and look at the displacement of VEGF, iodinated VEGF, from the receptors. So as you can see, you can, if you add more and more cold VEGF, you can displace the iodinated one. But if you add 121, the freely diffusible one, it doesn't, you cannot displace it. So these cells express both VEGF receptor 2 and neuropilin naturally. So this is our first prediction. The prediction of the theory has no adjustable parameters. All the kinetic parameters, very fortunately, were available from in vitro experiments. In vitro, I mean, not even the cells, sort of a BioCore, for example, where just receptors and ligand are taken in solution. And here's the prediction of the theory. There was one parameter that had to do with collision of receptors, neuropilin and VEGF receptor 2. That reaction rate was not available, so we used diffusion theory just to see what the frequency of collision between the two receptors are, and that's the straight line, and from here it's reduced by a factor of 10, 100, and 1,000. So as you see, even 100 of 10 doesn't change the conclusions of the theory.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You were saying that you use the reaction diffusion equations, so you're treating these VEGF molecules as diffusing molecules.
Right, in the solution.
In solution.
Right.
And this morning we heard talks that VEGF are bound to the extracellular matrix.
Right, that's in vitro, so there's at this point there is no extracellular matrix. So
the cells are making extracellular matrix, aren't they?
They're making extracellular matrix, the basement membrane. And so I'll show you the next in vivo simulation where we have the extracellular matrix and two basement membranes on the endothelial cells and on the parenchymal cells. And so you'll see.
Is there any serum present in the cultures?
In the experiments, no, I don't remember how it was, whether it was serum in that experiment.
Yeah, because there's a huge amount of matrix in serum.
Right. But these are very fast experiments. Yeah. So what I'll show, for example, either 2 hours or 7 minute measurements, which are on the order of what it takes to phosphorylate the receptor. So these are not long-term measurements. So this is another experiment where this is with HUVEX, and these, in order to get the point, we have to sort of measure the density of the gels reported. So these are not publication quality numbers. As you can see that the VEGF, there is a difference in the affinity for or activity for phosphorylation for VEGF 165 and 121, very significant by an order of magnitude. This is what the theory predicts, again, no adjustable parameters here. And let's see. Now, if you remove the neuropilin, though, from these endothelial cells, then experimentally, VEGF 165 and 121 behave approximately the same. And that's what the theory also predicts. So, very important differences that stem from this heparin binding ability, even in the absence of the extracellular matrix, just because of the presence of neuropilins, that 165 can couple to VEGF receptor 2 and 121 cannot. Yes?
So are you assuming that the VEGF dimer binds one receptor and then another, or does it bind two receptors at once?
No, it can bind 165 first and then bounce, just collide with neuropilin or bind neuropilin and collide with, so both types.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have reaction rates for all of those.
Right. So this is another set of experiments, independent, where the cells were transfected. Either these were porcine aortic endothelial cells. So either VEGF receptor 2 was present, or neuropilin, or both. These experiments were done by Shai Soker, who is presently, I guess, at Wake Forest. But at that time, he was at Harvard working with Michael Klaxburn, who discovered really the whole neuropilin story on endothelial cells. So this is these are results for 2 hour exposure of VEGF, and it shows the fold increase of VEGF to receptor 2 binding due to the presence of neuropilins. As you can see, it's a several fold increase in binding. This is for 2 hours, and then an experiment from Canada at 7 minutes, and that's the theoretical prediction for 7 minutes. 7 minutes is again important because of the that's characteristic time for receptor phosphorylation. And so this is the on the right, the same experiment. It's the fold increase of VEGF neuropilin 1 binding due to the presence of receptor 2. And well, considering that these are sort of molecular biological experiments, this was just quoting that it's up to twofold. And that's what the theory predicts. And then they stage a very ingenious experiments where they mixed, they had a co-culture of cells expressing VEGF receptor 2, which is called KDR in humans, and neuropilin, and mixed the cells. And then this VEGF 165 present can actually still couple the receptors, even though they're on different cells. And so here's what the results of the experiments were for binding on for single cells. So this is for receptor 2, for cells expressing receptor 2. This is for cells expressing neuropilins. And then you expect that the mixture would have just the sum of the two. But in fact, it was much more than that. And so to explain this, the theory as reflected either in vivo or in vitro situation has internalization rates. So receptors, when ligated, are internalized at a certain rate which is known. But it's interesting that in this situation, when these receptors are connected but they are in different cells, it makes it much more difficult to internalize because you have to pull the other receptor. And so it's this effect of the internalization rate that is slowed down very significantly in this case.
Is it possible that there's some conformational? I mean, isn't it also possible there's a protein conformational change that there's I know in some of the integrin work, if you know, a ligand, an integrin binds a ligand, and then there's a conformational change in the binding affinities go way up, and it's that's why
there is a possibility. This is used just to validate the theory, but it's possible there could be other information. So now let me show you the in vivo applications. I guess it hasn't been mentioned. I'm looking at things that have not been still mentioned at the meeting, and maybe a list of diseases has not been mentioned. Recently, Nature came up in December with the whole issue devoted to angiogenesis, and so one of the papers actually listed diseases, about 70 of them, associated with angiogenesis. And so these are just a partial list of diseases where anti-angiogenic therapies would be desirable. For two of them, we already have drugs. And these are a partial list of diseases where pro-angiogenic therapies would be desirable. And I must say that the pro-angiogenic therapies in peripheral arterial disease or myocardial ischemia have been tried for about 10 years in a number of trials, probably exceeding 20. And all of them failed, even though in animals, like injection of either a protein VEGF or gene delivery works very well, but somehow in humans, maybe after a very brief initial vascularization, it goes away. So there's a need to understand it better. So I'll show examples. We have actually collaborations with both peripheral ischemia and cancer. Let me start with skeletal muscle. So the model is that we first have a base of skeletal muscle with existing vasculature that looks something like this. This is done for a rat muscle extensor digitoris longus, which has been really the most studied muscle in angiogenesis. And so we can also solve the problem and calculate using reaction diffusion convection equation, the distribution of blood flow and oxygen tension. What we'll do in this case, our first question was rather simplistic. So it's known that if you exercise a muscle or electrically stimulate the muscle for a week or two, then a capillarity or capillary density goes up by 50% or more. Unfortunately for us, if you stop exercising, it goes down by 50%. So, not only in rats. So the question was, really, we don't have experimental evidence of how VEGF is distributed at the microscopic level. There are just not enough existing methods to study this at this resolution. So the question is the, are there gradients of VEGF? Diffusion is very fast. Diffusion of VEGF is fairly small molecule, so it diffuses sort of within tens of seconds on the scale of muscle fibers. Is, are there VEGF gradients? And so this is a muscle. This is cross section with muscle fibers just arranged in regularly, but capillaries are placed randomly in correspondence with what's known about capillary distribution, what statistical characteristics of this. And so in this particular simulation, the fibers secrete all fibers secrete VEGF uniformly, and I'll show later where they secrete non-uniformly. And so this is VEGF distribution in this cross section, and this is the histogram, and you can see that at the scale of a muscle fiber, in this case it's 37 micron fibers, so percent VEGF change per 10 microns is 4%, quite significant. So just in resting skeletal muscle, primarily because of this random placement of capillaries, there are sufficient gradients, local gradients that could navigate sprouts.
What is the half-life of VEGF? So it should stay alone. So the half-life is shorter, so it degrades.
It degrades, but it's constantly secreted by fibers, and so then it binds to the receptors. In this case, of course, what we have is extracellular matrix presence and two basement membranes, one on the around capillaries and one around myocytes. The basement membranes are on the order of 50 nanometers, but very dense. So just to give you, I think that question has been raised of how much free VEGF versus bound VEGF. These calculations and also calculations of fibroblast growth factor show that the only a couple percent of the ligand is in free form. The rest is bound to the receptors on the endothelial cells, to the two basement membrane, and to the extracellular matrix. So most of the ligand is bound. Therefore, by the way, could be freed locally by proteases. So this was done for fibers secreting VEGF uniformly, and this is a more complicated. This will go into connecting different modules. So what's done here is that we have existing vasculature. We simulate the distribution of oxygen. This is for the case of corresponding to moderate exercise, and moderate exercise with hypoxia reduced PO2 in the intake. So you can see that the oxygen, the PO2 falls quite low. Now, there are existing data that connect concentration of hypoxia-inducible factor alpha that Celeste Simon talked about, the transcription factor that activates 200 genes, but including VEGF. So the data originally come from my colleague Greg Simoncic, who discovered HIF-1-alpha. So it's a hyperbolic curve. The lower the oxygen tangent, the larger the concentration of HIF-1-alpha in the cell. And so there are independent data that connect HIF-1-alpha in exercising skeletal muscle with VEGF secretion from a different lab. So you can combine the two, and that's what's done. In this case, we did not use a very detailed molecular model of HIF-1-alpha, but simply an empirical correlation. And here is this mosaic picture of how fibers would secrete VEGF. As you can see, it's a sort of complicated picture when hypoxia is present. This is the distribution of VEGF in the interstitial space, including basement membrane and extracellular matrix, at three positions, here, here, and here. It's just very hard to visualize it because it exists only in spaces between the fibers. That's what we're visualizing. And these are color-coded for VEGF bound to the surface receptors.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When you're saying fibrils, you mean the muscle fibrils are secreting
muscle
VEGF?
Muscle fibers secreting VEGF.
Yeah.
Right. Depending on their local PO2. As you can see, this is heterogeneous, and so we take into account actually the number of nuclei in the fibers because these are multinucleated cells. So this is another cut, just showing this mosaic picture of secretion from fibers under different conditions. What really puzzled us when we got into this business, when we calculated there are known bulk numbers of interstitial concentration of VEGF, they're in picomolar range. And so when you calculate what a picomolar concentration is, that's less than one molecule per cubic micron. But the micron is the characteristic dimension of where VEGF lives. So then we started, so we are dealing with partial differential equations describing concentrations of receptors and ligands, and so we were puzzled of maybe it's not a good idea to, because these are such low concentrations. So we did a Monte Carlo study with receptors 1 and 2 presence and putting these concentrations of ligands to see if we can reproduce continuum concentrations. And it turns out that we do, but in addition to that, of course, the noise is quite high at this concentration. And if, depending on how the cell integrates the inputs from different receptors, it might be a different picture, but that's not something that we know at this point. Perhaps aggregation of receptors plays some role in amplifying the signal, which is otherwise very, very noisy. So this is another simulation that shows therapeutic technique, a cell therapy that has actually been tried. And this is injecting myoblasts in an ischemic muscle. And the myoblasts secrete VEGF at rates that are 10 times higher than the existing myocytes. And so here's, this is I think one cell that is marked here, that is this myoblast. And as you remember, that the mean gradients is double in this area, which is 30 fibers. So, and gradient, as you can see, the local gradients go up very significantly. So it is possible to, depending on what the density of this myoplast is, to affect both local gradients and the mean concentration of VEGF in the fiber. So let me switch gears and talk about cancer applications now. And the theory is quite general, but the particular simulations require numbers like capillary density and cell size and so on and so forth. So this is done for breast cancer, but I don't think that the results would be different for other cancer, although you'll see that this context dependency is very significant. I'll show that. So there's these elements that are taken into account. So we've already shown that neuropilin increasing the binding of isoform 165 to its signaling receptor 2, and signals through VEGF receptor 2, but not neuropilin. So we hypothesize that targeting VEGF-neuropilin interactions, we can decrease receptor 2 signal. And let's do the simulation and show whether it would work or not. So we'll test three anti-angiogenic strategies that target neuropilin. And I must say that we're in the process of starting this experiment with an oncologist at Hopkins. At this point, we have theoretical predictions. So first, we can block neuropilin expression. For example, that could be done by conditional knockout or small interference RNA. And so you apply this and neuropilin is not expressed. So this is strategy number one. Strategy number two is to block VEGF-165 binding to neuropilin. That could be done by covering the binding site for VEGF-65 by a molecule, for example, it has been done actually, a fragment of placental growth factor could be done, so it just blocks that site but doesn't affect receptor 1, for example. So this is strategy number 2. And the strategy number 3 would be to use an existing antibody. Again, there is an antibody that was developed by my colleague at Hopkins for an entirely different reason. He's a neuroscientist, or two of them actually, neuroscientists, Kolodkin and Ginty. They developed this antibody, and they didn't quite know how it worked. In this in vitro study, we showed that the most likely action of this antibody is to interfere with the coupling of neuropilin and receptor 2, but not with the binding of VEGF to neuropilin. So this is just one molecule. Of course, there could be molecules could be synthesized to prevent this coupling. So here's the first strategy. So we have 100% neuropilin expression. This is base cases for Shuvax. And then we knock out neuropilin gradually. As you can see, we have a transient decrease of VEGF receptor 2 binding and therefore signaling for receptor 2, but it comes back within 48 hours. And the maximum we can get is about 40-some percent decrease. If we block the VEGF-165 binding to neuropilin, then depending on the concentration of this fragment that we are using, let's say it's a PLGF fragment with exon 7 taking out, actually, then we can get again a transient decrease by about and then comes back and sometimes overshoot. And to understand, it's possible even qualitatively to understand why it happens, very briefly, what happens as you knock down neuropilin, then the receptor 2, the binding to receptor 2 goes down, that leads to an internalization of VEGF goes down, that leads to an increase or buildup of VEGF bound to the matrix, and then that resets eventually within certain time, that resets the VEGF binding to receptor 2. So the third strategy of interfering with the coupling for appropriate concentrations of the antibody, and it saturates at 1 micromolar, leads to a very profound 80% and sustained decrease in VEGF receptor 2 signal. So to just summarize this, this is at 48 hours, this is blocking the coupling, this is blocking neuropilin expression, this is blocking the binding of VEGF to neuropilin. As you can see, this is a preferable strategy.
That's assessed by phosphorylation of VEGF receptor. Is that how you?
This is assessed by the binding of VEGF to receptor 2, which results in sort of proportional changes in phosphorylation and signal.
You're measuring the phosphorylation state as an index of its being ligation, the degree of ligation.
Right, ligation is the index for phosphorylation and downstream signal. So this context dependency of that has been mentioned several times, and what does it mean in this quantitative sense? What it means that the predictions of this and presumably the behavior is very much dependent on the expression of receptors on specific cells, like what is the combination of neuropilin receptor 1 and receptor 2 on endothelial cells, but in cancer it's complicated that all of these receptors are also expressed by tumor cells. We have not taken into account because it has been characterized. But as you can see, these are different combinations, and this is the strength of inhibition, and depending on where you are, presumably on different tumors, different tumor types, or different conditions such as pH, then results could be quite different. Nevertheless, the third strategy, as you see, sort of has a larger volume of this inhibition. So in conclusions to this, we have a computational model that of interactions of isoforms with receptors in vivo. We tested three strategies, and it shows prediction is that the strategy predicted to be most effective uses neuropilin to sequester VEGF. So essentially what this third strategy does, if there is sufficient amount of neuropilin, and it's non-signaling receptor, you prevent it from connecting to signaling receptor, and you essentially turn it into a Avastin type drug. It sequesters VEGF, but it doesn't presumably do anything. So it has to be tested, of course, in vivo. Let me, in the remaining time, show you our studies on proteolysis of metalloproteinases. So the invading cells generally, and endothelial cells in particular, secrete metalloproteinases and express MT1, membrane-type metalloproteinase, specifically on its leading edge. And this happened to be an invading cancer cell. So what we will do, consider a model of a cell as a cylinder, very simplistically. So immersed in collagen one, we will, for in the beginning, consider one family of metallic proteinases. And let me see, this is the motivation for this study from the laboratory of Krister Betscholz, who did these experiments in the eye of formation of sprouts. And so this is a cartoon showing tip cell throwing filopodia and sort of either sensing the environment chemically or mechanically, nobody knows at this point, and then proliferating stalk cells behind it. It's interesting that according to this study, the migrating tip cell does not proliferate. I think there was some discussion of this.
It's
the cells do not proliferate and migrate.
Right.
And so the tip cell is migrating, expressing the proteases. The cells behind it builds the sprout and proliferate. So the question that we asked was very simplistic. We know that the velocities of migrating cells, sprout formation, are on the order of several microns per hour. So what's the limitation for this? Is it the proteolytic machinery of the tip cell, or is it the locomotory machinery of the cell? And so the locomotory machinery is extremely complex, and a lot of people are working in this field, so we decided we'll carve a small niche here and try to answer the question of whether proteolytic machinery is consistent with this velocity. So we painstakingly reconstructed one major family, MMP2. There are about 30 of them, and so the most implicated are MMP2 and MMP9. MMP9 was very elegantly demonstrated by one of the organizers, Dr. Irela Arispe, to release the isoform 165 from the matrix and clip it, which result in a diffusible form and a form and a segment that stays on the matrix. So this is the biochemical system. So just to illustrate that there are several major events. The metalloproteinases, almost all of them, are secreted as pro-MMPs. That means they have to be activated first. And in addition to this, there is a tissue inhibitor of metalloproteinase. There are four, family of four, discovered. So the TIMP2 is involved with MMP2. So it's interestingly that it's inhibitor. It can inhibit activated MMP2, but it's also necessary to activate it. And so there are several steps that it has to bind to MT1 MMP, form a triplet, then it clips the part, and active part of MMP2 is released, and then that could be inactivated. Then there is ectodomain shedding, because two MT1s can interact too and shed one sort of catalytic head from one. And then all of this could result in proteolytic reaction for collagen one. And also other things like cleaving receptors and so on. So first, again, we validated the model for fortunately available in vitro data on the proteolysis of collagen one, and then the model is set like this. So we have a moving cylindrical cell. So we go to a coordinate system fixed at the cell, so the matrix moves, matrix and the environment moves around it. These are the solution of Brinkmann equation for sort of porous medium. Then let's say we consider a matrix concentration of 10 or 30%. Tumors have lower matrix concentration. Things like skeletal muscle, heart have high matrix concentration, concentration of solid phase. And then the cell at time equals zero starts secreting pro-MMP2 and TIMP2, and then expresses MT1 on its front surface. And we wait until the proteolysis is sufficient. Of course, the cell cannot move into a matrix that has 30% solid phase. Has to degrade sufficiently. We don't have good data on whether it's 2% or what's the critical degradation of the matrix through which the cell can move. That probably has to do with sort of percolation properties of the matrix. But we assume that it's 2% here. So the collagen at the front of the cell, collagen fraction falls. As you can see, it takes some 20 minutes, and then starts moving. And as it starts moving with different velocity, we specify the velocity and see whether the proteolytic machinery can keep up with the motion. That means if the velocity, if the fraction is small enough, then the proteolytic machinery is adequate. If the cell moves too fast, then it would go back to high values and sort of would be hitting the wall. As you can see, velocities of several microns per hour are consistent with the proteolytic machinery. Yeah.
That's what we got in the paper with Sleeman and Nielsen Hamilton about several microns.
It's very nice. I think we have a complementary probably approaches because we considered very detailed biochemical reactions with TIMPs and
The cell response to BEGF.
So this is the spatial distribution of MMP2 and TIMP2 at 30 minutes. As you can see, this is, I think, about 5 micron diameter cell. It diffuses quite a bit. And the cell is migrating upward. So this is in low collagen matrix, and this is in high collagen 1-fiber matrix. So what turns out, interestingly, from these predictions, that MT1 MMP by itself is sufficient to proteolyze the matrix. The diffusible part plays some role, but it's sort of not necessary. You get the same type of velocities with MT1 alone. So these are velocities for different collagen matrix. So the conclusion is that whatever the role of the limitations of the locomotory machinery of the cell, the proteolytic machinery is just adjusted to move with these velocities. Yeah.
Are these empirical data that you're?
No, these are results of the calculations.
Yes. You know, there's this product that's fluorescent gelatin, and it's great. You know about this,
right?
Because you could probably get a physical measurement what the fluorescence bloom is around the leading edge.
We have a collaboration.
We put that in just embryos, and we see fluorescence, but we don't have enough. I mean, it's just not a clean enough optical.
Right. Well, that in vitro.
Oh, in vitro would be much nicer.
A paper from Japan published last year came up with just that result, that MT1 is sufficient. It was another paper actually based on our prediction, quoting regarding the ectodomain shedding, the role of ectodomain shedding for MT1 MMP that I.
What's causing hydration?
the migration in this case, the cell just moves. We move the cell with a constant velocity and see whether the velocity, whether the proteolytic machinery sort of keeps up with the velocity.
In other words, you assign the velocity
yeah.
based on the matrix degradation they have.
We assign the velocity and make prediction
cell.
Of the cell, the matrix degradation at
yeah.
the front of the cell, and if it goes beyond several percent, we just say that this velocity cannot be sustained.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we don't address the point of
I know you
yeah.
So I'm just saying on the
it's almost right behind these sensors.
Whether
so you're basically saying you move the cell at a certain
right.
velocity,
right.
You know, the cell might move in response to the gradient it creates,
yeah.
right.
as a result of the degradation.
Right. So you can couple it with a model
yes.
of the one like the one that you're considering, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of what the multi-scale idea is. Right. So this is, I'm running out of time. I'm finishing just the, if you go to MNP9, which we've completed this work, in order to predict the release of VEGF from the matrix, it goes into quite a bit of mathematical and biochemical complexity. This is just the reactions for activation of MMP9, not even the proteolytic part.
You haven't done the MMP production from as a response
no.
to growth factor.
No, that's another story. That's another story.
That
of course, signaling events are involved.
Yeah, signals.
Yeah. But as you can see, that MMP9 interacts with two teams now, and MMP2 and 3, and so the complexity is increasing, but we, again, are fortunate that several labs really have produced enough data on MMP9s that we can validate and find a number of constants. So just as I'm finishing this, what I've demonstrated is building our modest attempt to build VEGF module and MMP module, and I haven't shown HIF. And you've seen some of this application that was previously developed. And then what we now have is also a rule-based discrete cell module. So it's based on agent-based modeling and three-dimension cells are discrete and so they can sort of crawl. And then they would have input from this, and that's where the things like haptotaxis and what sort of the how to link those, that's where they will come. So just the last slide is not really using that model, but a more simplified algorithm is predictions for sprouting versus splitting modes of angiogenesis. Splitting mode has been also demonstrated. It's not quite intussusception, but it's sort of a variant of that. And fortunately, in this case, it could be compared with the experiments on RET. So just in summary, we presented predictions from several molecular level models. We validated it to extent possible in vitro, and they await validation in vivo, like the neuropilin therapeutic strategy. And those we will try to use as building blocks to put together with models of at the cell and network level. So just to acknowledge the students and postdocs in my lab, then collaborations at Johns Hopkins in several departments. I spent a sabbatical a couple of years ago at Harvard, which has a certainly a high concentration of angiogenesis, and collaboration on peripheral arterial diseases, a new collaboration with the Duke group, and then this collaboration is with an MMP physiologist or biologist, doing in vitro experiments, the kind that you mentioned. Thank you very much.